Well, he's a young Salvationist. I think the girls think he's very cute. He's a student at our college. He's a keen believer with a very teachable heart. And he wanted to start well, and it so happened that his first major essay was in church history, which happened also to be my area, and so I knew the sort of preparation he was putting in to get this essay ready. He was doing enormous amounts of reading, journals, books, textbooks, spending time in the library. When he didn't have time in the library, he was photocopying journal articles and reading them off campus. He was taking copious notes. And you'd always see him with his briefcase. And the briefcase would be stuffed full of research, data, material that he was collecting for this essay. Then one weekend, his father came and picked him up and took him to the city. They parked their car in the parking station, and after being in the city a while, returned to their car and found that it had been broken into. Nothing had been taken, except he thought he had brought his briefcase from college, but probably mistaken. It wasn't in the car anyway. They returned to the college at Croydon, and the briefcase wasn't there either. He began to get desperate. All those hours of work, all the collection of that material, all the data, all the research. Where's his briefcase? They returned to the city, went to the parking station, and they began to search through the parking station. He was desperate. And then he heard his father call from a distance, "Darren, come here!" He ran to where his father was. They were at the top of the stairwell, and his dad pointed down and said, "Look." And down the bottom of the stairwell, there were just papers spread everywhere. Apparently the thieves took the briefcase and they weren't interested in early church history. But Darren went down and he collected all those beautiful pieces of paper and beautiful pieces of research. You see, you can feel the desperation when something is lost and the great relief when that thing is found, whether it's your credit card, whether it's your cash that you've already paid tax on, someone else has got it. Or that frenzied cry of parents on television when their child is lost, that the child might come back and be found. Now for me, I grew up in a family where my mother owned the car, and when my father went off to work, he had a company car, and my mother had a little Morris. And she was always losing things. She was always losing the keys of the car, but even more disconcerting, she was always losing her teeth. And so we knew that unless she found her teeth, we could never get out. It was always a relief to go looking through the house looking for Mum's false teeth. Well, how is it for you? Lost and found. When you come to this magnificent chapter in Luke chapter 15, the Lord Jesus tells us four cases of lost things. And it's a reminder to us, isn't it, that however we categorise people, you might categorise people according to colour, but that, for God, is irrelevant. You might categorise people according to their age, or their sex, or their occupation, but those categories are irrelevant to God. You might categorise people according to their denomination. That is irrelevant to God. You might categorise people according to their being good or bad, but the problem is we all fall into the same category there. We are all bad. And the way God categorises people is he categorises people as to whether or not they are lost or found. And so you see here that in the first story, in verses 1 to 7, it's the story of a lost sheep, a shepherd who has 100 sheep, and he goes out, and they naturally wander. Therefore he secures the 99, goes off into the far country, he finds this lost wandering sheep, he's so overjoyed with it that he puts it on his shoulders and he returns home, and in verse 7, the Lord Jesus says, "I tell you that in the same way there is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons." That is verse 1, the Pharisees and sinners, the Pharisees and tax collectors who do not think that they need to repent. And then the second case is in verse 8. It's the parable of the lost coin. A woman has 10 silver coins and she loses one. Now these coins are even more hopeless than the sheep. At least the sheep can bleat. The coin can't do anything. Just sits in the corner and waits. And see, she turns the house upside down, searching for this coin. She searches carefully and finds it, and when she finds it, there is great relief because she's found a tenth of her wealth. And the Lord Jesus says in verse 10, "In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." Now notice, in both these stories, there is something which is lost. The owner makes a search, the owner finds that which is lost, and there is great relief and joy. In the first case, it's a seeking shepherd. Then it's a searching woman. Who is this shepherd? Who is this woman? It is God. Who is this lost sheep? Who is this lost coin? That's you. That's me. We're helpless apart from God. And apart from God and relationship with Him, we are totally lost and helpless. But God is a God who searches. He is a God who loves. God doesn't sit back and say, well, there's 99 here. Why worry about the lost one? I've got 9 coins here. Why worry about the extra? No. He is a God who searches and diligently searches as long as there is one lost remaining. Now, some people might stand back from this and say, well, I'm lost, and God had better get his act together and find me. Because I'm sitting here waiting. Yes, I'm helpless and I'm lost, and he hasn't found me yet. Well, now you wait. If you're in that category, there are 3 stories, and the third story needs to be taken together with the other 2. The third story is probably the best known, or certainly the best loved story that Jesus told. Verse 11 and following, the parable of the lost son. A couple of weeks ago I was reading in the paper that they had to close Taronga Park Zoo here in Sydney by the harbour. I don't think they ever had to do that before, but they had to do it this time because one of the animals escaped after feeding time in the morning and before the gates opened. It was the snow leopard. The snow leopard had actually chewed through his cage and escaped. It's interesting, isn't it? Here's this leopard. He wants to escape this prison. He wants to escape this cage. And so he chews through and he escapes. What does he escape into? A bigger prison. A bigger cage. You see, here is this elusive search for freedom. And whenever anybody searches for freedom, they're only climbing out of one cage into a bigger one. And that's why freedom is so elusive. And here, this story has a theme like that. Here is a young son. And he goes to his father and he wants to get out of the prison. He wants to get out of the sheltered existence of home. And he says to his father, divide the inheritance. Now the elder brother gets 2/3 according to the law and the younger son gets 1/3 of the inheritance. So it's divided up. And he goes off and he's going to sow his wild oats. He's going to indulge. He's going to live it up. And he does that in a far off country. And he squanders the inheritance on wild living. And when the dollars are gone, the friends that were attracted by those dollars are also gone. And he finds himself swilling the pigs, a very humbling existence and occupation for a young Jewish man, swilling pigs. And as he's swilling these pigs, he looks down at his hands and he realises, wait on, I'm my father's son. What am I doing here in a far off country, starving, a pauper, swilling these unclean animals? I will go back to my father and I'll say this, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Will you please take me back as a farm labourer? That's what I'll say. And so he gets up out of the pig swill and he returns home. Father, he says in a rehearsing way, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Will you please take me back as your farm labourer? What's the attitude of this father going to be? 1/3 of the inheritance is gone. You see, every time this father sat at table, there was always the empty chair. There was always the reminder that he had 2 sons, but only one was home. And no doubt his eyes would search the horizon until one day he sees a far-off speck. And as any father will tell you, he will recognise the speck that is his child. And so you have this beautiful picture that the father is so eager to get to his son that he does that which is singularly inappropriate in Middle Eastern culture. He pulls up his robe. He bares his legs. Can you imagine that? Men do not bare their legs. He bares his legs. He tucks his robe into his inner garment and he runs to his son. Meanwhile, his son is coming home wondering what reception he's going to receive. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Will you please take me back as a farm labourer? And even as he's rehearsing, he can see his father coming to him. And when his father gets to him, he hugs him and he sweeps him off his feet. But Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. Bring the robe for his shoulders. Bring the ring for his finger.
But Father, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Bring the sandals for his feet. But Father, will you please take me back as your farm labourer? Kill the fatted calf. For my son, who was dead, is now alive. He was lost, and he's now found. It's an incredible story. And each of these stories, just look at them again. In the first one, the ratio is 100 to 1 lost. In the second one, the ratio is 10 to 1 lost. In the third story, the ratio is 2 sons. One is lost in a far off country. In the first story, the sheep is far off. In the second story, the coin is at home. In the third story, the younger son is far off as well. Notice the sheep didn't search. The coin sat there hopeless and helpless. But would you notice that the son, he did return. He returned to a waiting father. He had sowed his wild oats. He had dreamed his dreams. He had been outside the cage, into the other cage, and he had seen what life was like out there. And now he was turning home. And how does he find his dad? Sulking? Vengeful? You're going to pay for this, young man? There's no greater day than when the prodigal returns. I told you so, young man. Oh, he sweeps him off his feet. Bring the ring, bring the robe, bring the sandals, kill the calf. Let's have a party. An overwhelming welcome and mercy as he turns his face to home. Can you imagine that? Of course you can. As a parent and love for its child. Remember a friend of mine up in Weewall when I was in the pastorate there. He found that his son, who was 18, 19 years of age, was being tested for leukemia. It was thought probable that his son had leukemia. And so my friend went to Narrabri Hospital and sat by the bed of his son. And I saw him the next morning when he came back from Narrabri. I said, how was it? He said, I simply took his hand in mine and I looked him in the eye and I said, son, I would do anything to exchange places with you right now. If somehow I could take this disease on myself so that you could be healthy again, I'd do it. And you'd do it, wouldn't you? You'd do it. You know, I've got 5 children. You put any one of those children into a life-threatening situation and take any of you and put you into a life-threatening situation. You're nice people, don't get me wrong. And I can only save one of you. You're on your own. I'll go for my child. Is not this father's love for his son showing us the amazing love of God, whereby he turns his face away from the son he loves in order that his love can go out to you, the prodigal? That God the Father should turn his face away from God the Son so that he can set his love on the ungodly and on sinners. That is amazing love. And here we see that God is the shepherd who seeks. God is the woman who searches. God is the Father who waits. And we are the wandering sheep. We are the hopeless coin. We are the wayward sons, lost and found. And the Father's great statement to us is the statement which he makes in the cross, where he says, I love you. That's how much I feel about you. I love you. Come back. And would you note that the sheep is safest back in the flock, that the coin is most secure back in the purse, that the son is most accepted and reconciled back into the family? Now, how do you think of God? Ask yourself that question. The Greek philosopher said, well, God is a big question mark. Guesswork is overall. I've heard theology lecturers say God is like a cloud. You can't be more specific than that. He's some sort of eerie thing out there. Ether, who knows what he's like? What do you think God is like? What is the prevailing image in your brain as I talk about God? It's an interesting question, isn't it? Do you think of him as a policeman, a magistrate up there at his bench with his big wig on? How do you feel of God? If I said to you, what's the prevailing image of this convention for you? I'll tell you what my prevailing image of this convention is for me. There's always a moment in conventions, isn't there? I'll tell you my moment. When that door opens, about 9:15, and Bonnie comes walking in. And I think, oh, is she going to be colour coordinated today? What's she got today? And she always is.
You see? And you go away thinking, yes, I remember that moment when she came in. When she came in this morning, it wasn't a great entry. Even we had it on the overhead projector. We didn't have the colour. What is your prevailing image of God? When you think of God, what do you think of? Look at verse 20, would you? Because it seems to me in all of the New Testament, there is no greater, more pervasive image of God than we find in the image of this Father. Verse 20. He ran to his son. He threw his arms around him and he kissed him. The father hitching up his robe, baring his legs for public view. Oh, the neighbours gossiping. Did you see him this morning out there? We saw his legs. He was so eager to get to his son, and he runs and he doesn't even listen to this rehearsed speech of his son. He sweeps him off his feet. And all his concern is that he was dead and alive, lost and found, welcome home. This is a God, friends, who parties at penitence. It's incredible, isn't it? Look around our assemblies and our churches, and often you'd wonder, wouldn't you, whether these people are followers of a God who loves to party. But he does. And what he parties over is penitence. These are the people who follow a God who looks at the human anatomy and says, wow, aren't those feet beautiful? Now that's incredible, isn't it? Wow, look at those feet. But he does. The feet of those who bring the gospel, they are beautiful feet. Let's have a party. Because the one who is dead is alive. The one who is lost is found. Verse 7 and verse 10, I tell you, in the same way, verily, verily, I say to you, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents. Great party. Well, I said there were four lost, and the fourth is a tragic figure in verse 25. The older brother. The English playwright P.G. Wodehouse said, a parable is a story of Jesus, which is a pleasant little yarn, but it keeps something up its sleeve, which pops up and knocks you flat. And here's the sting in the tail. A happy ending? Yes, the sheep's back. Yes, the coin's back. Yes, the younger son's back. Everything's great. No, because there's a party pooper, the older brother. He's the most lost of all. In fact, there is no record in Luke 15 that he was ever found. He doesn't go into the party. In fact, he makes a scene, and the father has to go out and plead with him. And he says to the father, listen, in his anger, I stayed home. This one, this son of yours, not brother of mine, this son of yours squandered all the wealth on prostitutes. And then when he comes home, you throw him a party. He thinks the worst of his brother. There's no love there. There's no care. You wonder, did these two boys grow up together? Where's this man's heart? And I tell you where it is. Go back to verse 2. That's where it is. Because those listening to Jesus, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they were muttering, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. It's a lovely word, that. Our kids have been learning this word, onomatopoeia. Onomatopoeia is this idea, so I've learned, where the sound of the word actually defines the word, like the word whoosh. You see, it sounds like what it describes. That's onomatopoeia. The Greek word for muttering is the word, it's onomatopoeic. It's the word gone goosemoss. They were gone goosemossing. That's what they were doing. Gone goosemossing, gone goosemossing. It sounds like muttering, doesn't it? It sounds like what it is. And these Pharisees and tax collectors, they were gone goosemossing. He's eating with tax collectors and sinners. Who were the sinners? Who were these dreadful people? They were people just like us. They may well have been good people, but they were not Orthodox Jews. He's eating with these sorts of tax collectors and sinners. This man is not lost far away from home. He's lost within the family. This older brother who comes and he says, how could you do this? He has all the appearance of being in the family. He has all the faithfulness and all the diligence, but he does not have his father's heart. There is no family likeness. It is this merciful, forgiving, loving, accepting heart of the father which he finds so hard to bear. But you look at this older brother and you say, oh, isn't old Joe, isn't he lucky to have a boy like that? When that other young bloke's gone off and left, old Joe's older brother. He's done the right thing and stayed with his dad. Appearances can be deceiving. Just last night on the news, I heard that in Queensland, the Courier Mail is running a story of a family who lived next door to another family down the road. This is just last night. And this other family had a crocodile as a pet. But they noticed that they treated this crocodile very harshly. Now, nobody really feels terribly sorry for a crocodile, but you can only go so far in your cruelty. And they started to beat this crocodile. And most days they'd get out and beat the crocodile. And so this family, rightly so, rang the police and said, look, we've got neighbours down the road who've got a crocodile and they're treating it very cruelly. They're beating it. So the police came by. They went around the back and found that the crocodile was actually a wooden crocodile, and the man was an expert woodmaker, and he was actually chipping out this expert crocodile, which they thought, that's Queenslanders for you, eh? Sorry, Eddie. Sorry, mate. Sorry, we save all our jokes against Queenslanders for the state of origin. That's over this year. But see, appearances can be deceiving. This man, this brother, looks at home. He acts like he's at home. And yet he is a complete stranger to the household. When the party's on, he's sulking. He's angrily sulking outside. Forgiveness is not for me. I would have made him pay. Dead, I'd leave him dead. Lost, I'd leave him lost. Squandered a third of the inheritance. I worked so hard for my part, but the Father has given him so freely what I'm working so hard to achieve. I resent him. I resent the Father. He's hardened in religious tradition. The pleading of the Father comes out and says, my son, everything I have is yours. Will you come in? But he doesn't listen to that pleading. And he goes on being lost. See the categories, good, bad, religious, non-religious, lost, found. You can be as lost inside the family as you can be lost in the faraway country. You can be as lost in religion as you can be lost outside religion. You can be as lost in the church as you can be outside the church. You can be lost in the pig pen. You can be lost with the prostitutes. You can be lost in the pew. And tragically, you can be lost in the pulpit. You can be lost because you do not bear the family likeness. You do not have the Father's heart. Well, what is the Father's heart? Go back to chapter 14. Let's put it in a context. Chapter 14, you'll notice that Jesus has been speaking about being a disciple. Look at verse 31. Will the king not sit down first? Chapter 14, 31. Will the king not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? In other words, you count the cost of being my disciple. Look at verse 33. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. And what is the great call to discipleship? There it is in verse 27. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Jesus has been saying in the context here, before we divided up the chapters, if you want to be my disciple, you've got to follow me, and that's going to cost you. Now, where will we follow him to? Look at where he goes, chapter 15, verse 1. He goes to the tax collectors and the sinners. That's where you'll follow Jesus to the tax collectors and the sinners, because that's where the Father's heart is. If you're going to bear the family likeness, it will be the likeness of having an outgoing heart, seeking, loving to save those who are lost. And the Father proves that beyond doubt, because he sends that which is most precious to him to do what? To seek and to save the lost. And I put it to you that it is easy, very easy for me to be lost and to cover myself in a Christian bubble. You know, sometimes I can go a fortnight without ever clapping my eyes on an unbeliever. I can sit there in the college, meet with Christian people, meet with Christian faculty, meet with Christian staff, meet with students, and I never even get to see an unbeliever for a fortnight sometimes. And I tell you, it is impossible for me to maintain my spiritual vitality unless I'm talking to some unbeliever about Jesus.
You should tell me, would you? How can you watch the videos and maintain your spiritual vitality? How can you not be sharing the gospel and maintain your spiritual vitality? I don't know. But I know that I need to be doing it for my sake and ultimately for the sake of the lost. A friend of mine just come back from the United States. He saw in the Bronx people going out from a church to do door-to-door, door-knock evangelism. And they were in such danger that they had to have a police escort to do it. That's a challenge, isn't it? What is the Father's heart? To seek and to save the lost. Early this year, the inventory in our family of pets was this: one dog, two cats, two goldfish, one budgerigar. Don't get me wrong, I've got nothing against pets. But then I heard in the radio that Liverpool Council here in Sydney was going to take one of their stray dogs, put it to sleep and pump all the blood out of it, give that blood to vets so that they could use it for transfusions when the vets had other operations. Well, when people heard that, people started ringing up Liverpool Council. People started ringing the talkback radio stations in Sydney, and there were people on the phone crying that they were going to do something as calloused as this: put a little dog down. And we do cry about cruelty. We cry about the killing of whales and the killing of dolphins, rightly so. But where is our concern for lost and perishing humanity? Where is our concern for lost and perishing humanity? This older brother comes before us as a real example to us, to us mutterers, to those mutterers and us mutterers, that you can be so close and yet so far away. You can be at the dining room table and not be a part of the family. Earning, working, deserving, he knew nothing of grace, and full and free forgiveness was foreign to him. When Jesus comes in verse 25, 24 and finishes the story about how the son was accepted home, how would you have finished the story? Let me give you a story ending. Here's a good story ending. The son is away in a far off country. And the older brother knows this and he says, "Don't worry, Dad. I'll go looking for him. And we'll be back. If he's alive, he'll be here." And he goes off and he finally comes to one of those hostels for dropouts. And he recognises this bearded person lying on this straw as a heap. This is his younger brother. And he goes over and he says, "Wake up. Here it is. Look, it's your older brother. I want to tell you, Dad yearns for you to come back. We both miss you enormously. Will you come?" "What do you mean? He's not angry? He wants me to come back?" "Yes, we both want you to come back. Come back." And the father's looking and he sees two specks on the horizon. He hitches up his robe and he runs to them both. Both his sons are back. "It's wonderful to have you back. Oh, son, the one who is lost is found," and the older brother rejoices too. That's the happy ending. But it doesn't happen like that. This is how the story ends. The older brother continues his anger against his father. "I cannot tolerate this free and open forgiveness. And these Pharisees and scribes were so angry that when the father sent his son into the world to save the lost, the elder brother took a cross and nailed the Lord of life to that cross. They savagely drained out every ounce of life from his veins." That's how the story almost ends. You see, this man has all the appearance of being a son in the family, one who honours the father, but he is intractably lost. He is hardened in his unforgiveness and his prejudice. So I ask you, do you bear the family likeness? Are you your brother's keeper? Too right you are. Are you involved in the search? This is a father who waits, who yearns, and who parties at repentance. A wandering sheep, a hopeless coin, an indulgent son, a hardened, angry elder brother, four losts, three found. Early this year, my wife and I had the great privilege of going overseas. And my wife's the cultured member of the family. She likes ballet and that sort of stuff. I don't really like that.
But we went to Amsterdam and we stayed with these people and they said, you must see the Rembrandt Museum here in the Reichstag or whatever it was called. So we went to see the Rembrandt and they said, you must see Night Watch. It is the most famous. You, of course, have heard of Night Watch. I'd never heard of Night Watch at all. We went and we got our audio cassette and we went on this art tour and you could see Night Watch because it was right down the end of this museum. There was a great column all around it and there were people all around it. And as I turned on the cassette, he told me that Rembrandt was a famous painter, that this was from the Dutch Golden Age, that what was outstanding about Rembrandt was his use of colour, dark shades, light shades, other shades. It was just, he was the great Dutch painter, apart from Van Gogh, but in that area, the great Dutch painter. Well, when I got down there and I saw this Night Watch thing, I thought, well, I don't think much of it personally. It's far too big, it's gaudy, it's dark. You know, it was that heavy sort of painting. I didn't think much of it. Do you think anybody lost sleep because I didn't think much of it? They said, hey, David Cook came and he didn't think much of Rembrandt. In fact, he gave it a 4 out of 10. What does it tell you, my judgment? It tells you that I'm a cultural Philistine. That's what it tells you. You see, my judgment is a reflection on me, not on Rembrandt. And it's like that with the heart of God, isn't it? I do not approve that God, with his dying breath, should say to a common thief, today you'll be in paradise with me. I do not approve that this father should accept this wandering son back without some form of discipline. I don't approve. And I don't approve that God should justify one of those fraudulent, traitorous tax collectors. I don't approve. But the father is beyond our judgment. In fact, we are judged by our response to his judgments. That really determines whether or not you share his heart. Your judgments determine whether or not you bear the family likeness. He is a God who lifts up the humble. He is a God who searches off in the far country. He is a God who is never happier than when one person simply comes to bow the knee and say, I'm sorry. He is a God who saves thieves. He is a God who forgives tax collectors and frauds. He is a God who hitches up his robe and who runs to you and throws his arms around you and kisses you and says, welcome. Do you share the family likeness?